Hey, Zero Block 30 listeners, you can find us every Tuesday and Friday on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Prime members can also listen ad-free on Amazon Music.
This episode of Zero Block 30 is brought to you by Lisa Mattress. Lisa Mattress is an innovative company that's an online mattress store. They're just like Tom's Shoes or Warby Parker for the mattress industry. They're available exclusively online and start at just $525. The mattresses are shipped in a compressed box directly to your front door. You cut it open. My daughter says it smells like chocolate. I think that's kind of a lie. Not really chocolate, but I mean, it's kind of good. Like if it is chocolate, 100% American made. Shout out to America. Zero Block 30. We're big pro America. We're not against America.
Big time pro America.
Zero Block 30.
Lisa definitely in the corner of America.
Yeah, we like it. And we like people to sleep well in America. So if you want to sleep well, go to Lisa Mattress. Get you a Lisa Mattress. Lisa Match. Fuck me. Lisa.com/barstool for 75% off. We're going to keep it this time.
Yeah, yeah. I like it.
Lisa.com/barstool for 75% off. Nope. $75 off. It's going to be one of those shows, boys. Buckle
I guess
up.
So.
Zero Block 30. Let's go.
Let's go.
I am in studio, not in Texas like I usually am. I am in studio, and I am joined by my good friends, Captain Connor and Young Rigsy. We are presented by Barstool Sports, as always. Gentlemen, how are we doing on this wonderful Thursday evening?
We are good. We are good. I think we say it every time you are here, but it needs to be said. Chaps, it's just always better when you're here with us, when I can reach out and just touch you.
Yeah, it feels good, man. Thank you for touching me, especially when I'm almost shaking the microphone off the stand.
Chaps, you're very handsome in person.
Thank
very
you,
nice to have you.
Appreciate it. Riggs got a haircut this week, so he's also looking handsome.
I did. I got a nice haircut. Yeah, it's been a fun week. It's always nice having Chaps around, as Con said, and yeah, it's a good episode. I'm pumped. I'm glad to be here. I love when you're in studio. I think we always have great shows.
I feel like there's a lot going on.
There is.
There's like a lot going on just, I mean, with our show, with Foreplay, with Podfathers. There's a lot going on with Barstool in general right now.
Which is a great thing. Busy.
Yeah, it feels like it's
moves.
Really heating up for the spring. Like
yep.
We're going into spring strong here.
We have, and it's a big week for Zero Block 30. Like you'll hear later on in the episode, we have an Iwo Jima survivor, 92 years old, that came on the show. We interviewed, Connor and I interviewed him last night. Tomorrow we're interviewing Hope Seck from military.com. Then we have Kevin Latch that was Chris Kyle's platoon mate in Ramadi. He's coming on the show on Friday. So we have just weeks and weeks of good interviews for you that you're really going to enjoy, especially the interview that's going to be a two-parter with the gentleman that we interviewed yesterday, because 92 years old, four major Pacific battles that he was a part of, wounded in one. It deserves a part two.
Like yeah.
Part one, part two.
Yeah.
It's an hour-long interview, so we're going to break it up for you in two different parts, and I can't wait to get that. But more on that as we move forward. This week, when I come up, I will say this. When I come up and I'm in the office, it's very difficult because I try to pack in so many podcasts. Like
sure.
I have Podfathers as well, so I'm doing four or five episodes of that, ZBT stuff, trying to get on other podcasts and just like really make my time here worth it.
Absolutely.
So I feel like I don't know what's going on the internet.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So it's
because you're away from your computer. Like when you're
yeah.
at home in Texas, you're, you know, in front of your computer for the majority of the day when you're not in the bathtub.
Yeah.
So, but even there, you got your phone.
I got my phone.
So you are very much dialed in. And when you're here, you're so busy.
Yeah. I like walk out and I don't know what time of day it is.
Yeah.
I don't know what podcast I just got done doing.
It's unbelievable in this office how out of the loop you are on the internet when it's an internet company. Like we make our fucking dollars by being in the
yeah.
loop on the internet, crushing the internet, covering like nobody else covers the internet. When you're here, you got no fucking clue what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, you guys
yeah.
were out of pocket. You guys went up and did a hockey video for however many hours, and
yep.
you might as well have been on a different planet
because yeah.
you were just, you didn't know what was
we're
going on.
We were all rushing back, checking our phones and all that. But yeah, when you're in the office, it's tough. It's tricky. It's a lot easier when you're at home. For whatever reason, you get your TV on. You're kind of doing your own thing, moving at your own pace. You can check the internet. I have no clue what gets posted on Barstool throughout the day. When I'm here at the office.
Yeah, and that's how double blogs happen. But, I mean, people yeah. that are just listening to ZBT, not huge Barstool,
right.
don't really know what that's about. But anyways, the things that I did pay attention to, I watched some of President Trump's speech, and what were your guys' thoughts on his first speech in front of the joint session?
I mean, from a speech standpoint, you know, it was probably one of the better ones he's done, and everybody's been commenting, you know, he stuck to the script, he stuck to the teleprompter. You could clearly tell from dozens of different quotes that he, you know, he didn't write it. It wasn't how he typically speaks, which is what a lot of people, to be honest with you, are hoping for. It's funny to compare that to Obama, who a lot of the criticism was, oh, he never veers away from the teleprompter. He's just a teleprompter guy. That's the world we live in. At the end of the day, I wrote this in my blog. It's a fucking speech. A speech is just pageantry. It doesn't mean anything.
Yeah.
It does hone in the message. All it takes is one day of him having a bad Twitter rant, and we're off message again.
Well, we had that really with what we're going to talk about next with Sessions, but we'll keep on.
Yeah, so that's my main takeaway. Yes, it was a good speech. At the end of the day, it's a speech. You know, it's just that's what it is, and it is what it is. Social media is always fun for that. I like capturing stuff. I enjoy it. It's right up my alley, but speech is a speech. I like seeing action.
I don't get these people who want to criticize for reading from a teleprompter. What president in history has had the time necessary to memorize a 60-minute speech?
And that's... I think that's a very important distinction, because now's society is so much different than in the 1960s. And we talked about this some last night amongst just us three. And what I mean by that, FDR, whenever he was president, didn't have to worry about PolitiFact popping up on CNN or popping up on Fox News, mm-hmm. popping up on NBC and saying, actually, no, that's wrong.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it was weeks before they knew. Now, I do think that having PolitiFact and shit like that is a beneficial policy, and not just because I like more liberal shit, but I liked it when Obama would say stuff that was fucked up, then it was wrong. The American people need to know real facts.
Like, sure.
Especially in a fake news society, like PolitiFact being a non-political organization that just goes facts, when it's simple things like, we're going to upgrade $54 billion and this is going to reduce the cost here, when they're like, no, that's not going to happen because it's not possible.
I think a lot of people, too, need to understand that the speeches, it's not just Trump and maybe one guy writing the speech and they write it a day before and it's good to go. People have to understand that the words, the wording, the speech gets cross-checked, cross-referenced with different departments. They give feedback. A lot of times they test it against, you know, polls or samples of people to see how it plays and things like that. So there's a ton that goes into these speeches. So why the fuck would you veer away from it?
Yeah.
Those are the words. That's what you came up with. That's what you wrote down. That's what you took very seriously. A lot of your team committed a lot of their time to that, and he delivered it well. Props to him. We'll see what happens now.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. We'll see what happens. Because it's almost like a fancy PowerPoint presentation.
Right.
Sure, it looks great. That's awesome. And I thought he did a good job the way he delivered the speech. I thought he did good. But it's hollow until he makes good on the things he said. So, I mean, he could have said any number of things. And obviously, both sides are going to pick him apart. And also, I think that's a good point to make. People from, you know, the quote-unquote left media and right media, both sides said he did a good job from the reactions that I read.
Yeah, and one thing I took away, too, is I thought it was his most presidential moment.
Yes.
He wasn't up there bitching. He wasn't calling the media fake news. He didn't really mention the media. It was very presidential. He stuck to things that sounded important, and he made them sound important, and he made you believe that he thought they were important.
Like, it wasn't like he was a clown.
Right.
Exactly. And I feel like that's a super low bar for POTUS. like, while we're saying that this is a really good speech, if any other president in recent memory gives that speech, you're like, Jesus, dude. Like, come on. But it's like, it was a paint-by-number speech. America's great. We're going to make it better. We're going to do this together type speech, which is absolutely what he needed to do. But like you said, like, he has got to actually fucking do it, and you want to see him making those type of remarks off the cuff, not the remarks that, because the remarks that he made about Senior Chief Ryan were very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they were very nice remarks.
Mm-hmm.
The remarks that he made to the reporting pool and to the governors, that it was on the generals, like, they lost him. Those, whenever it's off the cuff, is when he needs to be more presidential, because like you said, words are extremely important, and when you're using phrases like, they lost him.
That was horrible.
The buck has got to stop at the commander-in-chief. That's any company. It doesn't matter if you're the manager of fucking Taco Bell. If something goes wrong, you take the blame.
Yeah.
And he knows that. And that's what's frustrating, is when he does the off-the-cuff thing and he comes off as very, you know, not sincere at all. Because he knows that. He's been the executive. He's run massive companies. He knows the buck stops with him. He ran on that. I'm going to do this. I'm going to, you know, I'm going to get rid of ISIS. I'm going to be, you know, strong and committed and make good, solid decisions. And then you can't be like, they lost him. That's bullshit.
Right. And bringing up President Obama, when you gave the go-ahead, it doesn't matter if fucking JFK has been looking at the mission and he looked at it in 1960. That doesn't fucking matter.
Mm-hmm.
You're the one that's sitting in there that gave the green light to go. If you give the green light, that's your fucking mission.
Yeah.
Even if it was Mattis that gave it, even if it was whoever.
It doesn't matter.
It stops there.
Exactly.
The blame goes there.
He has to be accountable. And Chaps, you know, from being a non-commissioned officer in a leadership position, the hardest thing to do is to take that accountability and say, nope, that's on me, when you know it has nothing to do with you. And you could
see and
someone else.
I mean, I kind of disagree, dude. Like,
you don't think that's hard?
That, to me, and this is going to come, oh, fuck me. This is going to come sounding like really patting myself on the back. I relished to take that off because I looked at my Marines knowing that they fucked up. When I would go, and it's a much, much different scale than someone dying. I'd never had that on my watch that I felt like I was comfortable or like responsible for. But if one of my Marines fucked up, I would much prefer as the company gunny to go to my captain or my major and be like, yeah, it's on me. I didn't train the boys well enough. We're going to do this, this, and this to fix it. But I would go in with the plan to fix it on how we did it. I had no problem taking blame because I think that's part of the job. If you succeed to get to the point where you are successful enough to actually lead men and women, you have to be big enough to take the responsibility. And I think you should take that as a privilege that you're in that position to take the blame off of them and heap praise. It's basically Bill Belichick. Belichick will never say we won because of good coaching. He will never say – he will say we lost because of bad coaching.
Right.
We won because of good players.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that's the model of leadership of what you should do.
He said many times –
behind closed doors is different.
Right.
Call their asses to account behind closed doors. That's completely fucking different.
Yeah.
I feel like two chaps that you would, you know, in that type of scenario that you just painted, you would earn a ton of respect from your Marines.
No, you have
them
to.
Them knowing that, you know, he takes the fall. He's our fucking leader.
Yeah, and they're less likely to make those mistakes again because they see that you are willing to do shit for them. You hold people accountable behind closed doors and take responsibility in public. That goes a long fucking way no matter where you're at.
Right.
Yeah. No, I guess I was thinking – I wasn't necessarily thinking about, like, subordinates because I agree with you. I don't think it's as hard with your subordinates because you want to look out for your guys
but that's
no
what
matter what.
Guys, that's what the generals are to
yeah,
him.
Yeah, ultimately,
they
yeah.
They are his subordinates.
Ultimately, yeah, they are his subordinates. But I think when he points at them like that, it's almost like, hey, they should know more than me because they're the generals and they're –
still,
oh,
that's
no, no.
chicken shit.
I agree, and that's why it is chicken shit because I don't care that they have all the military experience. I don't care that they have the rank. You're the commander-in-chief.
Yep.
Take the responsibility. Don't even bring up their name. It doesn't matter because guess what? It's not just them either. It's the five people below them that told them the intel, that gave them the information
yeah.
from when they took and made their decisions that eventually went to you. Like there's so many people below all those layers. It's so convoluted. You got to just say, well, that's on me. I made the decision.
So let me ask you guys this. How long do you give a bit of a grace period, a bit of growing pains, a bit of, hey, he's never been a commander-in-chief?
0 days.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's it.
For that job, zero.
But
like, if you run for that job, you have to be prepared for it. And when these are real people's lives.
But I guess I don't mean like for mistakes of decisions like that. I mean for how you handle the PR of it, like saying they lost it.
Zero.
Things
no,
like that.
Zero. Because like you said, he's been the CEO of business his entire
right.
life, like basically his entire adult life. He should know that's a basic tenet of 101 leadership. Take responsibility for your subordinates. And I don't feel like you should get any grace period on that. I didn't feel like it when President Obama was the most junior senator when he was elected because he wasn't fucking ripe with experience either.
Yeah.
But I feel like no one was making that argument. Well, Obama's brand new, so some of these drone strikes that he's doing in Afghanistan were fucked up. They were like, no, you're the president now. It's on you.
Yeah, because the other thing, too, and I won't speak for Chaps, I'll speak for myself, but prior to like getting into a leadership position, one of the things I was told time and again was, you're ultimately going to be accountable for anything that happens, whether
good or bad.
Good or bad, yeah.
And that's a reason why officers get higher medals than enlisted guys a lot of times, because you take responsibility for the good and the bad.
Yeah.
If I do something good, if I'm in his company, I do something great, he gets credit for it, too. He does something great, I don't get credit for it.
Yeah, that's
true.
That's
just how it works.
And it makes you wonder how much people – I totally agree with you guys. And it makes you wonder how much people need to really think about these things during, you know, the campaign process and the election process and all that, because you nailed it right in the head with Obama was the same way, where people were like, this guy isn't really an experienced executive or he hasn't necessarily been a skilled leader. And he did, I feel like, especially early on, throw a lot of blame. And Trump's been doing the same damn thing. And it makes you wonder, like –
And he
these
got
guys
shit
don't
on.
Get
and
grace
got,
periods.
And he they, got shit on for it,
both
too.
Both got shit on, and it's like, these guys don't get grace periods. They're running for fucking president. Yeah. Make sure they can handle it beforehand or don't vote for it.
I feel like operations that you do, you get no grace period. It would be unfair, just like it was unfair for President Obama when he first came into office to expect him to fix the economy within 2 months.
Right.
That's unfair because you can't move the economic needle that quickly. Just like it's unfair for Trump to take responsibility for the goodness that's going on economically the first 2 months now because he's not moving it that fast either. Like, sure, the Dow and shit like that spikes, but the Dow moves up and down anyways.
Right.
But jobs and shit like that, once we really start to see the 100, that's why the 100-day mark is really where it's at for most presidential policies. You can see what the effect is of what Trump's doing at the 100-day marks, but militarily and decisions that affect people's lives like that has got to be day one. When you step into the job, there is no grace period.
Yeah, and the other thing is, though, too, and Chap said it, it's the optics. You know, it's if him blaming these generals, that just doesn't bode well for his relationship with the military, especially with such a high profile mission where, you know, I'm willing to bet he would have been banging the drum had it we not lost the Navy SEAL that we did.
Senior Chief, I was
blanking on his rank, Senior Chief Owens. So I mean, if you want to take all that praise, you got to be ready to take the blame too. And you know,
and this isn't something that's new either.
No.
I mean, it happened with President Bush whenever 9/11 happened. They looked back and they were like, well, Clinton had an opportunity to take bin Laden out and he didn't do it. And then Clinton was like, well, actually, HW had an opportunity and so did Reagan. Like,
yeah.
I mean, they went back and forth. But you have to be like, I'm the president. This is on me. Mm-hmm. And even taking the blame gives you credit, like to the American people.
Right,
when
exactly.
When you take blame, you're going to get credit. If he stands up there and be like, you know what? The decision that we made here might have been the wrong one, but we did it with full confidence expecting to get this. Did it turn out the way that we wanted to? No. But the fact of the matter is the success or non-success of the mission does not change the fact that Owens is a hero.
Yeah.
So that changes matters not. Now, what pisses me off about the Democrats, and I will say this, if they want the motherfuckers that were sitting down when they did honor his wife, that is fucking horseshit because that's the point where you have to move your politics aside and look Democrats in the face and be like, you're a motherfucker. Just because it's Trump saying it doesn't mean that you can't stand up and clap in that moment. You don't want to clap for his policies. You don't want to clap for his appointments, what he wants to do, immigration, whatever. That's what you should be doing. You should be making a principled stand on what you believe in. But you better get your fucking ass up if you're a senator or a member of the House of Representatives for somebody's wife who just was killed in combat.
And I completely agree. And one thing that I feel like I make a distinction in that situation, or that people should, is that that's not Donald Trump, the guy that you hate, you know, recognizing the sacrifice. That's the office of the President of the United States recognizing that. And that you respect no matter what.
And I'm not a Trump fan. 99% of the stuff that he does, I don't like it. I don't think it beholds the office of the presidency. Mm-hmm. In that moment, he is the commander in chief.
Yep.
Shut the fuck up and get on your feet and clap.
Yeah, because guess what? Senior Chief Owens,
now
he didn't let me make this point. He didn't make that sacrifice just for Republicans or just for Democrats. He made it for everybody, for the United States of America. So for you to not honor his memory and honor his wife, who was being spoken about at that time, that's just a complete bullshit move.
Yeah, and I do think that this is kind of what I tweeted about it a little bit. And I've kind of gone back and forth, and this is where I'm sitting now. Where I'm sitting at it from 3 days from now might be completely different. I understand why the administration invited his wife. That's a tough spot to be in, like as his wife.
Okay.
Because you have the awkward moment where he's like, well, we just broke a record because you're honoring him. But it's just like making it the death of a service member, even the tiniest little bit, political. And I feel like that's what they made a mistake with the guys in Benghazi, is making it a political issue. And I hope that Democrats don't do that. Like when I see his dad coming out and speaking out that he wants investigations and stuff like that, I understand wanting to get things right. But that is a very dangerous line to toe, that every single time a service member dies, we bring their parents out and make their parents speak on why they died. Like it happened with Captain Khan. Like it's happening here. It happened with the guys in Benghazi. That is a dangerous thing to do.
Yeah, their lives should not be made political in any way.
At least now, give them some time.
Yeah,
like, give them some time away.
Yeah, I agree. I will say, having military members who had some sort of significant impact on the war on terror, whether it's they received the Medal of Honor or it was a family member of someone who has passed, being at a presidential address, that's nothing new.
No, it's not.
We've seen that before. But now, yeah, it is kind of becoming a little more common that, you know, one side...
It's starting to creep in there. And I don't have... Yeah. I mean, honor them any way you want to. And she accepted the invitation, obviously. They didn't fucking drag her in.
Right.
Like, she was going to get mode into the fucking congressional hall. Like,
yeah,
that's
right.
Not what happened. Like, she didn't go to chambers that way. But it's just like, okay, let's be careful here.
Because we
can't do that every time a service member dies.
No, you can't set
do
that precedent. It was a nice way to honor his memory and to honor her. But I don't want to see it become a political chip for one side of the aisle or the other.
Because what happens whenever the next guy, and it's 50 that die?
Yeah.
You know, like 50 go down.
Yeah.
You're going to bring all of them on and like interview? Like, do you want to have an investigation? You're going to take polls? Is it going to be a democratic process on how to do that? Like, it's just a very slippery slope to go down. Another slippery slope to go down was Sessions with more Russian rumors. Riggsy, what the fuck happened there?
Good old Sessions. Yeah, he this ambassador, this Russian ambassador to the U.S. is considered by many to be one of their top spies and spy recruiters that they have. And he's our guy. He's apparently, you know, the reports came out that he had met with Sessions a couple times early on last year, 2016. Sessions says, you know, they had no politically related conversations. The Democrats, of course, came out and said, you know, they demanded Pelosi and I believe Schumer demanded his resignation. They said this is the same thing Flynn did. How come Flynn has to resign? He should resign. Sessions said he wouldn't recuse himself from the investigation that's going on, the probe, if you will, into kind of Russian involvement, Russian communication in the Trump campaign and ultimately the Trump administration. Then he did recuse himself.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like,
in 24 hours.
Why would you recuse yourself if you're really not? So not a great look.
Well, because I think it's, again, it's optics.
Yeah.
It's like whether or not you're telling me you didn't speak about any of these things. Well, you two were behind closed doors and you're known to be a Trump guy. And then fast forward, Trump comes to president. It's like, eh.
And not only that, but he said specifically in his confirmation hearing when he wasn't even asked.
Yeah.
Like he wasn't even asked.
Yeah.
It wasn't like, hey, did you ever do this? He volunteered the information and said, I never met with anybody from Russia.
Sure.
Yep.
And that's what's going to ultimately fuck him because that's perjury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. No, if he perjured himself, yeah, I was just going to say, that's a crime.
And you can't be the highest law enforcement officer
committing
in
crimes.
The land and
cannot
commit
be the
perjury.
You cannot be the AG. That's just, you just can't do it. So he's
and
not
he
looking
had a
good.
Lot of red flags on questionable shit before. So if anybody should have been skating a nice little clean line with a toe pick figure skate, not even a hockey thick skate, should have been a figure skate skating that line, it should have been him.
Yeah, so not looking great. And like I said, this fucking Russian ambassador guy, I'm blanking on his name, it's Rush, but he's bad news. Anybody that's related to him, anybody that's had this stuff with him. Sessions' title at the time, too, was like kind of like loose, like advisor-ish related to Trump at
the
time.
And he admitted that he was in an advisory role.
Yeah, and so it's like, you know.
Made Trump supporter from the beginning.
Right. It was like they were trying to keep him at arm's length so that he could go to these types of meetings almost, it looks like. So it was.
But even arm's length.
It's very much a gray area.
You're right.
You're talking about like the legit cabinet members meeting with those guys. Normally, like, even on House of Cards, they have, like, some, like, even Doug Stamper was going out.
Right,
like,
you said Stamper.
It wasn't Doug Stamper. It was actually fucking Frank Underwood that was going out, you know? Like, come on, dude.
Yeah, so not a great look. Again, I think to kind of tie everything in with the speech, it's going to be really interesting to see if they can kind of smoothly, the Trump administration I'm referring to, can kind of smoothly navigate through this next little hurdle that has nothing to do with the message that they painted and try to move on and try to get their agenda done. And you know, so it'll be interesting to see how it works out.
Well, the good thing, at least, it gives us plenty of shit to talk about. Because, like,
us
narrowing our topics down now is getting difficult.
Yeah,
it is.
Which scandal do you want to talk about? Let's talk about some scandals.
It doesn't sound like it's going to be, you know, going away anytime soon either. We got Oprah apparently running in 2020.
Yeah,
so
the Disney dude.
The Disney guy where he's throwing their hat in the ring.
Anybody celebrity with $1 billion is like, fuck it, I'm going to run.
Well,
basically, if
president.
You got a Q rating above 50, your name's in the hat. Right?
Yeah.
Some Oprah-Trump debates would be off the charts.
That'd be
content,
great.
Content, content.
And I hope the fucking every single thing that happens in the political arena now, we're not calling for everybody's resignation and majoring over minor shit. talking to a top Russian spy, a pretty big deal. But
yes,
like,
right.
I don't want to get into the point where anything remotely bad happens with somebody that just because they have an R in their name, like you're like, they've got to step down and like
yeah.
explode.
Yeah.
You talk to a Russian spy, probably appropriate for you to ask for you to step down. But if you're doing something just a little bit wrong, like step out of line, fucked up a policy procedure, because there is going to be a lot of that with brand new undersecretaries, secretaries all over the fucking joint, there's going to be some mistakes that happen.
The backlash has been hypersensitive right around now.
Yeah.
It makes sense. I hope it kind of calms down,
think
so. Back
that's
down.
How it was in the Obama administration,
I was
just
going to say, yeah. I think that's how it's always been.
When
always
they
people
first, I mean, what happened yeah. when they first, the very first thing, who was the, Harry Reid, right?
Yeah.
No,
I don't know
Reid.
What you're trying to get at.
The fucking senator, the Republican senator, the majority whip. Anyways, we'll cut this part. We're not going to cut it, though. So the lead Republican senator, whenever Obama first came into office, basically said everything that he tries to do, we're going to knock it down.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. He literally said that.
Yeah. Like said it like basically just like that. Anything he tries to do, we're going to knock it down.
Yeah.
Now, the Democrats don't have that option because they control everything.
Exactly.
So you're just going to piss and moan and be pissing and moaning, which...
Pissing in the wind.
That's what you got to do. I feel like when they're in their position, the only thing they could do is raise their voices, and that's why they were elected to their position, so they could fucking voice their displeasure. And it's pretty clear that they're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so again, hopefully we get back, you know, everybody relaxes a little bit at some point. Like you said, you don't want people jumping down throats for small, little things when there are very big things to be worried about.
Yeah, I don't want to hear it from our bosses that I fucked up the ad read at the beginning.
Right.
Just let me live.
Let me live. Let me
I
do
made
my
a
show.
Mistake one time.
Let
Come
me
on.
Do my show. I'm with you.
No, I agree with you too. It's just so hypersensitive, and now any little thing, people are just looking for any sort of spark where they can ignite the Trump fire and burn them at the stake. So it's almost getting a little tired. I agree. You know, Russian spy, yeah, that's a big deal.
Pretty big one.
We'll pay attention to that one. But we can't every day something happens in this administration jump down their throats and call for resignations and impeachments. I think that'll get too tiresome.
I completely agree. And on to a brighter note.
No, it's good to be here. I'm a big fan of Zero Block 30 and what you guys do. So it is an honor to be on the show.
Well, we're glad to have you, buddy. And I know that since you listen, you know what I Want to Be Like You is, but we'll refresh our memory. For the viewers, for the listeners, mm-hmm. There's not really any viewers out there. But if you were going to be a military guy, active duty, and you could do any job you wanted to, what job would you do and why?
Is this – I feel like I'm getting into stolen valor territory here,
right?
If I even hypothetically say. Do I have a pass?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
100% you got a pass. Yeah. Okay. Whatever you say is okay.
I think I would be really good at being a guy who retired from the military that goes around mm-hmm. filming stolen valor people and calling them out and then uploading those to YouTube.
Yeah.
How do those people get caught?
The stolen valor people?
Yeah. It,
like, what they do is they have, like, just ridiculous uniforms that you just know is not. Like, so they'll wear a rank of somebody who's, like, an E4 mm-hmm. with the medals of, like, a general. Like, if you were going to do it, listen up. If you want to be a stolen valor guy, I'll teach you how to do it.
How okay, to be a stolen valor.
Yeah, this
how
is
to,
good.
A little stolen valor 101.
For entertainment purposes only.
Yeah, just for entertainment purposes. Go down, get a low, Google what a low ranking member would wear. So get, like, a PFC or, like, an E4. Then only buy, like, 3 or 4 medals. Mm. The highest one possible that you can get and get away with it would be, like, a good conduct medal.
Probably, yeah. Maybe an Archon.
So you get a good conduct medal every 3 years.
Do you have, like,
an
okay conduct medal? Like, you don't want to try too hard here. Like, it didn't fuck up too bad.
Yeah.
No, like, and really in the Marines, like, you got to get, like, NJP'd to get your good conduct medal taken away.
Oh, but everyone gets a National Defense Service Medal. That's like a participation trophy.
Yeah, global war, and then a Global War on Terrorism medal.
Yeah, Global War on Terrorism.
That's where the military is going wrong here. The whole everybody gets a trophy, coddled culture of the United States military.
Day one boot camp, whenever you get there, you get the National Defense Medal no matter what happens. Okay. It's the ultimate participation trophy.
So what you're saying is the best way to get away with it is to not try too hard. Don't stand out.
Try to blend in.
Okay.
Yeah, so if you try to go, like, if you're wearing, like, bronze stars and purple hearts and silver stars and shit like that, people are going to look at you a little more closely. But if you're mm-hmm. just average Joe Schmo, like, in the airport wearing a little uniform because you're trying to get boarding group one, I'm not mad at you.
Well, so you're saying that you're not allowed to do that in an airport. I would think that would be kind of the one place that it's okay to steal valor. Because you want to get in that first boarding group.
Yeah,
you get
and I've said before on the show that I support people who want to do that.
Only on a Southwest
flight.
I'm not
mad at you. I understand anything you can do to get in boarding group one.
My dad has a boot and he fakes a foot injury
Sorry, PFT. So, because he gets so pissed off at like the 18 people that do wheelchairs so they get on before him.
Is your dad Ben Roethlisberger?
Who knows?
Yeah, so that's a good tip. I will only do it if it's a Southwest flight where I have to get there early to get, you know, through their whole politics of boarding.
Now, if I were you and you wanted to get away with a little stolen valor because you have longer hair, you have the facial hair now, so it's going to be obvious that you're not on active duty. You got to get a veteran hat, throw some pins in it, and then just kind of stand around bitching about, like, when I was active duty, I had boarding group one, this is bullshit, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. And maybe somebody's like, hey, you want to slip in with me? I'm boarding group two.
Okay. Yeah, you know? No, I like that a lot. Be a disgruntled.
Yeah, be like, man, I really miss on that being on active duty just
that's,
so I could
yeah,
get
yeah, that's
higher.
Almost even more subtle. It's a nice move.
Okay. Well, as someone whose entire military rank knowledge comes from reading the book Catch-22 when I was in high school, this has been very educational. Would you recommend staying towards the enlisted side or staying completely away from the officer side?
Stay away.
Yeah, I would too. Yeah.
No offense, because I know we're in mixed company here.
Right.
But I feel like officers, if they see another officer like walking down the street, they do an immediate inspection of that person. Is that true?
Oh, well, no, that's anybody.
Yeah, I think it's anybody, officers or enlisted. But if I saw another officer, I might be more apt to talk to him.
Mm. Yeah, that's fair. You don't want to talk to just
if
random.
If I saw an officer, I definitely would not talk to him.
Exactly. Yeah.
Smart.
Yeah, I'm like, fuck that guy.
I guess I should ask you guys, you know me, what would you recommend for my service in the military, hypothetically?
All right, so you want to go first?
Yeah, sure. When I knew you were going to come do this with us, I gave it some thought. And don't let this go to your head, but I think you would be an operator. You'd be like special operations in whatever branch. You know, pick your branch that you want to be, and you'd be in the special operations community. Because, mm-hmm. one, I think you got a lot of grit.
Mm-hmm.
Two, you're kind of like shorter, but you're like kind of like, you know, a little stocky.
I'm
compact.
Yeah, yeah, you're compact.
And low-key thick.
That's right.
You're low-key thick.
Thank you.
And I'll tell you what, that makes for the ability to go on long rucks and less injury. So I think you'd be perfect for that
community. So basically Delta Force.
Yeah.
I'm in Delta Force now.
Yeah, you get the hair, the facial hair. You'd fit right in.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Like, I could almost be, I could see myself in a paramilitary environment, maybe like a CIA operator or something like that. Behind enemy lines, I blend in with like whatever. If we're invading a country of people that look like Kid Rock, you want me to be blending in with
definitely,
them.
Definitely, because if there's anything that you're really good at is not making a scene.
Yeah, that's like, a good point.
That's your specialty, making a scene.
If you need to invade Detroit, you're calling me first.
Yeah, absolutely.
So mine would be different. I would have you as like a general level officer, as public affair officer. Because you are great at spin zones.
Dealing with the press.
Yeah, so I think you would be great at doing, like, the press conferences and shit. Like, somebody fucks up on base, let's send PFT out there. He'll spin zone it. He'll really put the media on its heels, and everything will work out fine.
You know what I think is great about, like, the military press briefings and why I think I would be really good at the job? Is because I can answer every question with, we can neither confirm nor deny.
And nobody can say anything because they want you to have operational security.
That's
it's a big deal.
You want me to get people killed?
Yeah.
Well, then I'm not going to answer your question.
I'm going to answer that? Well, it's just about like chow on base and why they don't have it.
Yeah,
like,
well, that's on a need-to-know basis.
Yes. Yeah, that's what you think it's about.
It's above your pay grade.
Right. Trust us here. Well, thanks very much. Go download. Pardon my take. We appreciate you coming on, PFT.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, buddy.
Yep. Thanks guys.
PFT. Woo.
Woo. Woo. Hooah. Can I say hooah?
Yeah.
Yeah, hooah.
Many times you want.
Hooah.
There it is.
All right.
We might have to like cut that out and make that a soundbite.
Okay, I like it. Yeah, make it a little drop.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Am I allowed to say Semper Fi?
Yeah.
I thought that was only like if you were a Marine.
Mm-mm.
All right.
Say it.
Okay, I'm very, very sensitive to...
I appreciate that. Okay. You're very cognizant about stolen valor.
Yeah, I am. those guys are like... I understand that... People that steal valor, they're world-class pieces of shit.
Yeah.
But a lot of times I feel like they also – like, yeah, there are some just assholes, but there's some that
I think
have,
they're
like,
just world-class stupid.
Yeah, and some of them have, like, mental issues.
That's
but,
it.
But I get so uncomfortable watching those videos because the people that like, get up in their face
– Usually
like,
the people who did that are shitbags, too.
Yeah,
they were
exactly.
fucking garbage while they were in.
Exactly, yeah. And so it's that whole – the whole stolen valor scene is just –
wild scene.
Endlessly fascinating to me.
And like Marines and shit, like soldiers, they fucking love it when they come across it, especially while they're in. They're like, oh, hell yeah. And usually the dude doing it is a piece of shit.
Yeah.
Oh, you know what else I think I would be good at is information person that sends out the videos of dogs welcoming vets back.
Okay.
Like that, I'm really.
That's more public affairs.
Yeah, that's like public a PAO, public affairs officer for sure.
Okay. Yeah, I'd be really good at that.
I like it.
Sweet. There we go. Thanks, buddy.
Or I would be also good at being the guy.
A lot of good things you'd be good at.
The guy at the NFL. Here, are we still recording?
Yeah.
I'd also be really good at being the guy in the NFL that charges the National Guard $200,000 to like bring a soldier out into midfield.
Again, public affairs.
There you go.
That's your wheelhouse. So we wanted to jump in before the interview that we're about to give really starts. This interview that Connor and I did is very different from a normal style of interview where we would normally ask the question, the guy would answer the question. This gentleman, 92 years old, still incredibly sharp.
Unbelievably sharp.
Yeah. Like, I wish you guys had the video because when he first signed on, he had like 10, 15 pages of handwritten notes of things that he wanted to say. So he really prepared for this and was ready, chronologically began. And I was ready to sit down with him and kind of walk him through. And I was expecting for us to have to walk. Were you as well?
No, absolutely. I mean, just by the mere fact that the gentleman's 92, you don't know what to expect out of someone of that age. But I was just so impressed with how he spoke. He was prepared, as you said. And then it was almost like we just sidled up on a couple bar stools and just listened.
And he basically had his Trump teleprompter ready to go.
Yeah.
Like, he was like, you'll hear in just a second where he sat down. We said, "Are you ready, sir?" And I was getting ready to ask him a question. And he was like,
he just went in.
February of 1943.
Yes.
And you're about to hear it. And this guy, there's certain spots in the story where you'll hear pain. There's certain spots in the story where you'll hear joy. Luckily, I had the microphone far away from my face where you didn't hear me get choked up, because the history behind Iwo Jima is something, as a Marine, that I'm very, very passionate about. It is the American battle for me. Like, many people attach themselves to different battles. I'm sure you have a favorite that you studied in history. Iwo Jima is the representation of everything that I believed in whenever I was training at Paris Island to the time that I got my retirement orders. It's everything that I wanted to be. It's everything that I aspired to be. And it's the cause of the greatest generation told from somebody that was in the Pacific. So let's listen now. Here we go. All right, sir, whenever you're ready, anything that you want to say.
All right. Now, you tell. I made some notes, but you tell me if they're what you need or maybe what you do not need. You just stop me if I get into an area that's not something you want. Okay?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Okay. I enlisted in the Marine Corps on February 10th, 1943. I was 18 and a half years old. I was discharged on January 4th, 1946, with a Purple Heart, having been wounded on Iwo Jima. My training consisted of initially at Paris Island in South Carolina. From there, I was sent to Camp Lejeune in North Carolina and put into an engineering company, and eventually was assigned to Camp Pendleton in California as part of a demolition squad. Now, I can tell you, if you would like to know what the job is of a demolition squad.
Absolutely. We would love to hear what you did.
Okay. First of all, a demolition squad is usually made up of a flamethrower and machine guns and various explosives. There are such things as known as a satchel charge, which is a pack of clay. Well, it looks like clay. It was called C2. It's a kind of an explosive. It was the job. It was my job to carry a satchel charge, and to see that it was used to blow up caves and bunkers and pillboxes. The flamethrower was to protect, to close the apertures of the pillboxes so that I could approach and anybody else could approach and get the satchel charge into the pillbox to destroy the pillbox. We also carried what was known as a Bangalore torpedo, which was a long pipe with explosives and was used to blow up barbed wire we carried maybe 5 or 6 of them. So if it was a long way off, we could connect them and then blow up a path to get into the closer to the pillbox. That basically tells you, of course, that we were receiving cover from other men in the demolition squad who carried grenades and they carried machine guns to keep the Japs pinned down while we approached the pillbox. From Camp Pendleton, I'm going on from there. My first stop, stop me if you want to.
No, you're doing great, sir. Thank you.
My first operation was in the Marshall Islands. That was the initial operation for the 4th Division, which I was a member of. And I happened to be a member of the 4th Engineer Battalion, A Company. The operation took place in the Marshall Atoll, where there were many small islands and one fairly good-sized island with an airfield. I spent 8 hours. That was the first invasion I made. I spent 8 hours in an amphibious tractor before we could land on that small island that we were assigned to. And I remember I got deathly sick from being in that tractor. And I had a friend, a very good friend, who saved 2 or 3 people in other tractors because the swells were so bad that they swamped some tractors and men were thrown into the water, and he jumped out and saved some. I noticed that I had never done anything more than a firecracker in my life, and here I was carrying in my breast pocket a a 4x8 piece of plywood that was an inch thick. In there were 8 holes, and the reason for carrying that was I carried the detonating caps in that would be used to explode the charges, and you could set them off with the heat of your hand. They were so fragile, so they taught me to drill holes aboard ship and plywood and slip these things, which were like a thin pencil, into this plywood. I carried it in, and we were fortunate. The little island that we landed on had very few Japs, and I went in, I guess it was the third wave, and most of the problem there was that the third wave started firing on what they thought was few Japs on the island that happened to be the guys in the first wave. Huh. That was what happens with inexperience. That was our first operation. Now, I saw something that I don't know how to explain it to you. You can take it out of this if you want. So
no,
print what you want. Imagine a 19-year-old kid hitting a beach, scared to death, and the few Japs that he saw had their penises cut off and stuck in their mouths. Can you imagine that?
That's a heck of a sight.
Yeah.
That's wild.
The crazy Marines, I guess whatever, there were nutty Marines and whatever. All I can say is that's something I wouldn't have done, but it jarred me. They were mutilated. And that operation lasted a couple of hours, and the island was secure. And they still had trouble on the larger island, where the larger island was called Badio, and that island suffered 737 casualties. I don't think we suffered more than 12 casualties on that little island we're on. It was over in no time. I wouldn't call that a major operation, except that 737 guys were killed and wounded on one of the other islands in the atoll. I returned to Maui. Unfortunately, I should say before that the few Japs that were captured on Badio, I noticed in a picture that I saw later, they were stripped. They only had loincloths on. And the reason for that is the Japs would put grenades in their loincloths, and when you captured them, they would explode the grenade, mm-hmm. so they could kill you as well as themselves. Well, most of the men that in my company and a few others, for whatever reason, we got sick. We came down with dysentery, and we were sent back to the Hawaiian Islands into what was known as Aiea Heights Hospital, and we recuperated there. I don't know if you know what dysentery is.
Right. It was really common in the World War II. I mean, in Guadalcanal, John Bassalone's platoon got it as well.
Yeah. And we went, after we left the hospital, we went back to our base, which was Maui in the Hawaiian Islands, a beautiful island. It's probably one of the greatest resorts right now. We were preparing to get ready to go to Saipan. When we went to Saipan, we stopped at Pearl Harbor for whatever reason. I was on an LST. I don't know if you know what an LST is, landing ship tank, which had a big, I don't know how you would describe it. It was almost like a ship that could carry in its hold 10 or 12 or 15 amphibious tractors. And when they reached the beach, they would open the doors on that ship, and the tractors would roll out, and we were in the tractors. So that the amphibious, the LST was a slow moving 10 knots an hour, but it carried enough tractors with enough men so that it made an impression on what, you know, instead of a lot of what we called Higgins boats, which mm-hmm. were different. Well, when we got to Pearl Harbor on our way to Saipan, I remember it was like Christmas, and we were sitting in a row. There must have been 6 or 8 LSTs lined up. And about midnight, there was an explosion in one of the LSTs. No one ever read about this in the newspaper. It just never came out. What had happened was they were welding something, and a spark got into some of the munitions, and it blew the hell out of one or two of the LSTs. Guys were jumping. This was in the Pearl Harbor before we even got to Saipan. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, we lost some men there. But then we slowly went across to Saipan. Saipan is a rather large island, mountainous, trees. Contrary to what a lot of people knew of islands, it was not flat. It was mountainous as could be. I was on an amphibious tractor there, and we received fire coming into the beach, which we did not receive at the Marshall Islands. The 16-inch guns on the battleships, which we sailed under on our way to the beach, you could hear those shells. They sounded like a freight train going overhead. The first night, we landed on the beach. We didn't lose too many on a first night, except first day, I should say. We didn't get our tractor hit. Some did get hit. The first night, I spent in the foxhole with an old buddy of mine. We were about 50 yards inland. And then about 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock, when it got dark, we started getting a lot of shelling around the foxhole. We got mortar shells and artillery shells. And unfortunately, when we morning came, we found that some of our men in foxholes had been cut up because the Japanese officers carried swords. And if you weren't awake, you could get your head half cut off. But we moved on a little at a time, and we got to a spot. I bring this up because it's notable. Got to a spot about, second or third day, where there was an incline and then a drop-off. And there was a pillbox down below, and we were assigned to get the pillbox knocked out. We had a young lieutenant, and he and two or three guys went down. The rest of us stayed back a ways. And as he got down, he was hit in the head by a sniper. and the two guys that were with him carried him back up to where we were. The two men that carried him up were also friends of mine. They were put up for an award, but I don't think they ever... When you go to court, what is it? I forget what you call it. I was called by many years later to find out exactly what happened so that these men could receive the award, but it never materialized. I also got to a point about 10 days later. We moved very slowly. It was a big island, and I was looking for a friend of mine from my hometown, and I got to his outfit that we were going to relieve, and I found that he had been killed about an hour before I got there. We moved on the island, and I remember a specific day, we landed, I think it was June 15th, but by July 4th, we had set up a line across the island. There was the 2nd Division, the 27th Army, and the 4th Division straight across the island. And I remember the 4th, it was very dark. And I was in a foxhole with another friend of mine, a big young guy from Philadelphia. He was about 6'2". He must have weighed 220 pounds. And we shared a foxhole that night, July 4th. And as we sat there, you're afraid to go to sleep. He and I were sitting back to back, so he could watch one way and I could watch the other.
Sure.
All of a sudden, I felt him shaking. And I turned around and I said, "Stan, what's the matter?" He says, "It's cold." It was about 85 degrees. But before you know it, I was shaking. There were two guys scared to death. And they could hear the Japs, which were not far away, yelling, "Marine, you died tonight." Unfortunately, one of our sergeants, who was an old policeman from New York, he was probably one of the oldest guys in the company, challenged some Japs coming up the road, and they said, "Who goes there?" And they killed him. They shot him. Of course, they got those Japs, but unfortunately, he lost his life. I'm just looking. We moved on to approaching the end of the island. I might tell you this is an incident you probably wouldn't hear about in the records. As I mentioned, there were three divisions lined up across the island. We were told that we were going to jump off at, say, 8 o'clock in the morning. A massive attack all across the width of the island with three divisions. As it turned out, the artillery preceded the attack, and then the artillery in front of my division stopped. They had bombarded what they thought was sufficiently, and we jumped off. The second division jumped off too. But I know you guys were in the Army, so don't take any...
Oh, no, sir. I'm a Marine.
He was a Marine. Oh, yeah. I was in the Army, sir.
Okay. So the only thing I can tell you is that you saw two Marine divisions moving out, and the Army didn't move. And the reason was, we found out later, that there was a General Smith was in command of the Army, and the overall command of the operation on Saipan was an old Marine named Howlin' Mad Smith. So they had two Smiths. And he didn't jump off when he should have. So we had our flanks. We jumped off and we had our flanks open on either side because the middle was open. Well, General Smith, Howlin' Mad, relieved the Army general right on the spot. You don't hear that too often.
No, you don't.
And he relieved him, and you never read much about that in the history books, but that's something that took place. Well, we got to close to near the end of the island. There's a rather, I don't say it's famous, the end of the island was like a cliff, maybe a drop off of 300 or 400 feet into the water. And the Japs were just about what was ever left of them, plus a lot of Korean slaves. The Japs had a lot of Korean slaves, men, women, and children, that they used for the sugar mills on that they had on Saipan. And they had them, they were all pushed back towards the end of the island. Maybe we were a 1,000 yards below before the end. And we were started shelling, because shelling the Japs at the end, but we knew they had very few artillery pieces left. So to show you how clever they were, when we started shelling, they started shelling, but they didn't hit us. They would drop their shells right in front of us or slightly behind us. And we'd get on the phone and call the guy in the back, knock off the shelling, you're landing short. And that's exactly what they wanted, because they couldn't compete with us. Eventually, we knocked out whatever artillery they had. And then a very sad incident took place, which became rather famous for pictures during the war. They showed all these Korean people jumping off the end of the cliff because they were told the Marines were going to rape them. So there were hundreds of men, women, and children that jumped off the cliff into the water, literally committing suicide because they were afraid the Marines were going to rape them. That place was known as Marapi Point, but it was terrible things to see. Well, we finished with Saipan, and the Saipan casualties, I'll just give you an idea. We were on the island 35 days, mm-hmm. and the casualties were wounded and killed almost 6,000. Wow. And then we got ready for Tinian, which was right across the bay, maybe a mile away, was a smaller island called Tinian. I don't know if you ever heard of it. That's where the B-29s flew off to bomb Japan. So we just didn't even get on a ship. We got into tractors, and we rode across the bay to get to Tinian. Well, the generals were smart. Tinian was not nearly as big as Saipan. It had a town that was called Tinian Town. And what they did is they sent a lot of cargo ships right opposite Tinian Town so that the Japs would assume we were going to land there. Instead, we landed in the other side of the island, where there was only a beach, which was unusual for a landing, of maybe 100 yards. No one ever lands on a 100-yard beach. It's crazy.
Yep.
But the ruse worked, because it wasn't that heavily defended, except as my amphibious tractor landed next to another one. They couldn't land more than one or two. It was so narrow. Mm-hmm. The other tractor hit a mine. Now, it was not an ordinary landmine. It was a heavy bell line that they use in the water. And it picked up that tractor, literally. I don't know if you know amphibious tractors. Literally picked it up out of the water and bent it in half and killed everybody that was in it. But we landed there, and we didn't have any opposition because the Japs were expecting us on the other side of the island. Mm-hmm. Well, that first night, I guess they recovered and realized what had happened, and we had a banzai attack, which is often misinterpreted. They just come at you. It can scare the hell out of you, but it gives you a chance if you got enough people to kill an awful lot of Japs, because sure. they just come in waves. Well, we got through that, and we moved pretty well after that, because the island was not as heavily defended as Saipan. We lost 2,000 men on that island. Now, the end of the island, something took place that we had never seen before. That was the first time we saw napalm used, dropped. I don't know if you know what napalm is.
Yeah. Sure.
And it was dropped at the end of the island, and then I guess whatever was left there, that was the end of Saipan. And it was secured. It didn't take long. I think it took 4, 5, 6 days to secure the island as opposed to Saipan. And we were put back in aboard ship and sent back to Maui to refurbish our supplies and the guys that got hurt and whatever, and to train again. We didn't know where we were going again anymore. So we got aboard ship. I don't recall this being, my memory fails me a little on this, whether it was a LST or a regular transport. I'm inclined to think it was a transport. And we sailed for what we didn't know at the time until we got way out in the ocean. We were told we were going to hit a tiny little island. It was about 10 square miles. It was called Iwo Jima.
So that was our story for tonight. And he has much more that you'll hear next week on part two. And you could hear that he was really just on top of his game.
Yeah.
As a 92-year-old man sitting in front of Skype, probably for the first time.
Probably.
With the first time he's ever had Apple earbuds.
Yeah.
His grandson sitting beside him, listening to these stories for what I'd have to imagine would be the first time that he's heard
those stories. Well, yeah, his grandson had told us, he had asked questions in the past, but he said he had only heard about half of what he told us about.
So and you'll hear about more from his grandson after part two of next week, where we brought him on. You'll hear that, and that was really powerful for me, because my wife just recently lost her grandfather about 6 months ago, and he was in World War II as well, and I think that she would really love to have these stories on tape, so it's going to be pretty special for their family to have. But we wanted, before we close, like always, we have save rounds alibis. Young Riggsy, you have any save rounds alibis?
I don't this week, boys, but I believe, Connor, you have some?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't know if you were alluding to something there, but I don't know. I don't believe.
No, I was, nope. I have nothing from old Riggsy.
Also, while Riggs is in here, again, go download, subscribe to 4Play, smash that, give it a 5-star review. It'll make you want to start playing golf.
Yeah.
So get ready to spend some money.
I appreciate that, fellas. We're gonna have you boys on pretty soon. By the way, we got to get Chaps, has recently gotten back into the golf game.
I have.
Well,
recently,
that's the thing. Chaps just said it, man. Listening to your podcast, obviously I know you and Trent, and so we have these conversations all the time, but listening to you guys talk about the game, listening to the stories that people have shared, and listening to the interviews, which, by the way, have been awesome thus far with the guys that you've gotten, has got me so juiced to be playing this year. So
a lot of people mad at us. They're like, I want to be fucking golfing right now.
Yeah.
And you guys are talking about golf, and I'm just sitting up here in the Northeast not golfing. Yeah. So it's been
10
good.
Minutes from my house, but anyways. All right, well, I don't really have any...
I do have a save round and alibi.
Hey.
Thank God I remembered that. All right, so, and actually, Riggsy, he might be a part of this.
Okay.
As I had mentioned, I am now part of Operation Heal Our Heroes, and you guys will be listening to this on Friday, March 3rd. On Saturday, March 11th, we are going out to East Hampton for a fundraiser, Bad Hockey for a Good Cause. Don't worry, I'll tweet out all the details, but basically we're doing a little pickup hockey and get a bunch of teams out there, and there's going to be transportation out there. There's going to be alcoholic beverages, non-alcoholic beverages, food. There's going to be a after party with live music. I think it's going to be a really good time.
I'll be there. Riggsy will be there.
Riggsy will be there out on the skates. Fights is going to be
there. I'll be retweeting the pictures.
Love it.
Chaps will be there in spirit.
Yep.
It's going to be a good time, so look for me to tweet out more information about that event. And seriously, if you want to come hang out and have a good time with us, the more the merrier. And all proceeds, by the way, go to Operation Heal Our Heroes. As a reminder, we are in the business of helping veterans get mental health care so that we can combat the veteran suicide epidemic, which is something that is very important and needs our attention. So please come support if you can.
And it's been something that has been a big issue for a long time, and we'll talk about that more next week on part two of our interview with the corporal that you just heard from. and it's going to be great, man. Like, just talking about him and what they what he battled after getting wounded on Iwo Jima. When you hear that story, you'll realize that PTSD isn't something new.
No.
It's not something that this generation is just a bunch of pussies that they developed. It was just called something different. It was called shell shock